BBC Radio 4, Michael Burke talks to Joe Glenton in The Choice.
Hello. Joe Glenton was a thoughtful young soldier, marked out for leadership, doing the job he loved in the army he thought of as home. Then he was sent to Afghanistan. Within a few weeks, he began questioning what he was doing there. Soon he faced the most difficult choice of his life, to stay with his mates fighting a war he didn't believe in, or abandon them and run away to the other side of the world. A clash of loyalties which, some say, encapsulates all the ambiguities of the Afghan campaign. Joe, did you find the inner conflict as hard as the actual conflict that was going on around you?
Yes, and perhaps more so because I was so very, very involved in it and it was internalised. It dominated my life completely at the time, this feeling of my obligation to my colleagues and my feeling of obligation to my own position ethically. It was really tough.
How did you get into the army in the first place? Did you come from an army family?
No, not at all. I think I had a great-grandfather at Ypres, and that was it, I think, and possibly an uncle in Suez, but no, by no means a kind of military lineage. It was probably a mix of the classic kind of economic drivers that, you know, push young men into the army, and a kind of naive kind of sense of patriotism and obligation and wanting to save the world.
What sort of background did you have? What was your childhood like?
I was born in Norwich, but we lived in rural Yorkshire, which is where my formative years were spent. And I was home educated, I think, from the ages of 8 or 9. And so me, and then a year later, my brother were educated fairly unconventionally.
What did your mum and dad do?
My mum was working as a housekeeper for the landowner. And my dad did various things. He was very much an outdoors type person and felled trees and worked on local hunts and agricultural work.
So what formal schooling did you do?
I was at primary for, I think, 2 years. I'd come home very angry as a child and it would be kind of wound up by school.
Angry about what?
Oh, just normal kind of kiddie things. I'm sure lots of children come home from school. I can remember asking them, actually, if I could leave school even at that young age, and they thought about it and said, well, yeah, you know, we'll educate you.
What was the homeschooling like? What sort of structure did they impose on your education?
It wasn't rigidly structured like a... like a normal class or a normal,
sort of
normal
no
school
lessons.
Environment.
They didn't give you lessons. What did they?
Not a rigid set of lessons, but certainly we learned and they would try and teach us. And if we had questions, we would raise them. I wrote voraciously and read greedily. And it was quite, I would shy away from using the word bohemian, but because they certainly weren't kind of hippies. They were very pragmatic people. But I mean, we learned freely and came out of it academically on a par when I reached the age of 15 or 16 as the guys who had been through that process.
A happy childhood, but then it all started to change for the family unit, which is your mum, your dad, you and your brother James. When did things start to come apart?
I think I must have been about 15. My brother had left by that time. He'd chosen to pursue a career in training racehorses. And I think, you know, wear and tear as relationships go down. And my mum, somewhere during that process, developed manic depression and they split up and things started to kind of spiral and probably did become more chaotic at that point.
And then you get kicked out. What happened?
I think a lot of it was probably just teenage angst. We argued over something that teenagers argue with their mums about, something ridiculous, and she kicked me out. I mean, she wasn't fully herself at the time.
And what did you make of that at the time? And what did you do?
Slept rough for a night, I think, and then went into care.
So the family had broken up. What happened to you?
I remained in care for a while and then eventually I got my first job in a hotel at, I think, 16. From there, I ended up moving back to Norfolk and worked kind of fairly mundane jobs and lived my life.
And then you got back together with your mum, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a strange one. She kind of stabilised and she kind of leapfrogged me down to Ipswich.
What were you doing with your mum then?
My mum at the time was working for the Refugee Council in an admin role. And I moved down and became involved in it as well as a volunteer. So we had a lot of people from the Balkans, people from Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, Iraq, places like that. So that was the first time for me growing up in rural Yorkshire where there are very few ethnic minorities and my first chance to come into contact with people from other parts of the world and particularly those parts of the world.
What did you make of the refugees and what did you make of all the arguments that were going on around all those issues?
See, I don't know at that point if I was kind of intellectually in a position, you know, I wasn't that political at that time. So almost a privilege in a sense to actually meet them and talk to them and ask them about the conditions of their lives and tell them about yours. They were fascinating people from all over the world.
And it was at this stage that you first got the idea of joining the army?
Yeah, I think I'd been kind of listless and young, I've probably bounced the idea around for a while. I mean, it's always there as a working class young bloke, you know, the rite of passage, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't want to kind of debate it at 21 or 22. I wanted to go out there and do it.
You didn't see any contradictions between working as a volunteer for the refugee council and joining the army?
No,
I mean, it's a ridiculous spoof, but it's one to which I would imagine some people in the refugee council might ascribe to.
Sure.
You know, join the army, see the world, meet new people, and kill them.
And kill them, yeah, absolutely. I suppose it is. I mean, I wouldn't have recognised that paradox at the time, but it certainly is one.
But tell me more about what drew you to the idea of the army at that time.
My contact with those people did make me want to be involved and help them. I think economic conscription.
You joined the army for the money, is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't have admitted that at the time, but I think certainly that's a factor. And I think I also had this sense of kind of patriotism.
And what about the prospect of actually having to fight, possibly kill?
Mm. Well, I was absolutely... I mean, I've abandoned the view now, but I thought if the government's doing it, it must be right.
But if you wanted to contribute, if you wanted to improve the conditions of people in foreign countries, why did you try and join an NGO?
It's a good question, but I think at that age, I don't think, you know, that was what I wanted. I wanted to be, you know, a soldier.
And what was your first impression of being inside the army?
I think at that early stage, I felt I was in the right place because you have that sense of other people like you, you know, you kind of fit into the machine.
What about the discipline? What about following orders?
Oh, I never had any issue with it. I was very self-disciplined rather than enforced discipline.
So you wouldn't just say you got by, you'd say you were... You loved it, by the sound of it.
Yeah, I did. I was a supplier, which is like a logistics kind of specialist.
You were the people who were basically responsible for getting the stuff to the fighting soldiers.
Getting stuff and getting the people to where the fighting is at times, so we have, you know, a lot of driving.
What were you told about going to Afghanistan? What were you told about the army's role there? What were you told about who you were fighting and why you were fighting?
Nothing really specific by the people in charge, who were told it was to reduce the growth of opium, to rebuild Afghanistan, to liberate women, to liberate the people, to keep Al-Qaeda out of our streets.
And what about who you were meant to be fighting? What did they tell you about that?
That, I mean, as far as we knew, it was Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which now you could argue a different case, but I couldn't have then because I didn't know. But we were going there to fight the bad guys. Effectively, it was as broad and as vague as that.
What was your first impression of the reality? Because I think you went in... When was it? February 2006.
Yeah.
What was it like going there? What was it like when you got there?
Going there, it was the first time I've ever been on a plane. Flew to Kabul, and then we flew to Kandahar. And it was the first impression of getting there was just the unbelievable heat and dusty.
And what exactly was your role in all this?
I and I think three or four other soldiers were assigned to do the ammunition. So we were slightly away from the rest of Kandahar, obviously, because it's full of ammunition in case it blows up. I felt like I was involved in something bigger and good.
What were the conditions like?
Initially, they were fairly basic, even in Kandahar, but not nearly as basic as the guys out in Helmand. I mean, they had much rougher tools than us. I think they call it R&R Kandahar.
So by Afghanistan standards, it wasn't that uncomfortable. Was it dangerous?
Was it dangerous? I suppose, yeah, in a sense it was, because you know, the camp was attacked fairly regularly, but with mortars, and those are, for the most part, almost kind of mundane. I mean, that's just what happens.
Well, there you were, working hard, in your element, admired by your superiors. At what point did you think things weren't right?
I think I started to see things and hear things which just left me with more questions. I think one of the salient things is a report that came through that the Americans had dropped a load of bombs on a group of women when the Nimrod crashed. I don't know if you recall, there was a Nimrod that went down with 14 guys on it. And that's almost an aside because it was equipment failure, but that struck me as a waste, I think. I think by about halfway through the tour, just the sheer amount of ammunition being used on a tour which we'd been told or we believe was about peacekeeping or defending women's rights or whatever. And on top of that, it was the vagueness, I think, of who we were fighting.
But it seems such a radical change from being an enthusiastic part of the group, part of the project, part of the army, to really turning against the whole idea of what the army was up to in Afghanistan.
It was a radical change, but it wasn't a sudden change. You know, it was over a period of time. And yeah, I think I just started to examine it, which is always, you know, mugged by reality.
But this was a reality you weren't even face to face with. I mean, the incident with the Americans and the and bombing people that included women and children, you weren't there.
No.
You did come fairly close to the Nimrod incident, didn't you?
To a point, we simply held the coffins, and I can remember driving them down on a forklift and taking them down to the medical centre where they were offloaded. But certainly...
These were the empty coffins?
These were the empty coffins, yeah, yeah.
That seemed to have made an impression on you then?
It did, yeah. It's just a memory that kind of stuck with me and recurred, that there was these 14 kind of coffins laid out and these 14 guys. And that just seemed a terrible waste. I mean, those weren't combat deaths. But I think certainly it made me think about their obligation to us and how seriously they took it. I mean, the people in charge.
Did you voice your misgivings anywhere else at the time?
When I was in Afghanistan, no. And I thought I would be kind of attacked.
Not even amongst your other mates?
No. No, it's a strange one because since coming back and having seen some of those guys, they also had similar concerns. But at the time, I mean, can you imagine such a thing? Soldiers asking why they're in wars, you know.
How long did you do in Afghanistan?
We were there 7 months, I believe.
Were you glad to get out?
Yeah, I was glad to get back. I think it's always a strange transition when we were kind of straight out. We hadn't seen a can of beer or a woman for 7 months.
But despite the fact you've gone on this long internal journey and found the army's role there to be one you didn't like, you'd actually done really well, hadn't you? I mean, you were moved from that regiment to another. You were promoted.
Yeah, promoted to Lance Corporal from private, which is still the lowest of the low, but to me that was quite good, yeah. Well, it's the first step. You know, I'd started to consider getting out, only kind of cursorily then, but that kind of was another something else to stumble over then. By that point, I was a leader. I was, you know, potentially going to be in charge of guys, and so my obligation was doubled, effectively, not just to the people left and right, but to people in my care.
How soon was it before you started developing what people would call kind of symptoms of some kind of stress?
I mean, they were probably there when I came back, to be honest, but I wouldn't have registered.
But if you're getting plastered, presumably...
Yeah, well, self-medication, is it? Yeah, it is, yeah. But probably when I got to my next unit, it was the start of 2007. Hmm. Certainly then it started to kick in. I was having trouble sleeping and ruminating, and it was kind of very tense and on edge. And a lot of that is tied back to the mortar attack we vaguely touched on earlier, which was kind of a near miss. And I would kind of, certain stimulus sets you off, like whistling sounds and car doors and stupid, almost cliched things. But I mean, that's how it works.
I mean, how dangerous had it been for you?
There's one that came in and landed very close, within tens of metres, and really kind of shook me up and hurt some civilians. Western civilians who were in camp, and that would kind of wake me up remembering it. And the same as the coffins, I would kind of wake up and from dreaming about the coffins and stuff like that. Even though, I mean, I wouldn't have said it was a hugely traumatic incident, but certainly the memory was very strong.
And how serious were they? What was your impression of how serious they were?
As a lot of soldiers do and are encouraged to do, denied them completely initially. But, I mean, pretty soon it started to affect sleep, and I was kind of drinking to sleep and stuff like that over the period of that couple of months.
And what did you make of this yourself?
Well, initially I was like, well, why are you being stupid? You've been weak, kind of Joey boy, sort it out. And also knowing that a lot of guys have been through much, much worse situations, and so you kind of shrug it off and go, you're not in a position to have post-traumatic stress.
Did you try to get help? Psychiatric help?
I did. I went and explained my symptoms, which is quite brave for me because I wanted to deny it. I was told by this doctor that I had low mood and stress.
Did you think you were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
No, and I think it comes back to the fact that I didn't feel I was in a position to be suffering. Like, what had I done? I'd been in R&R Kandahar, as they say.
Did they try to help you? Did the army suggest any...
Much, much further down the line, they did.
So you're back in this country... You've moved to another unit, you've been promoted.
Yep.
What happened then?
As soon as I got to the unit, we were told almost straight away that unit was going on tour to Afghanistan, but that 13 or 14 guys who'd been promoted at the same time and we'd all been posted to that same unit, but we were all protected by what they call the Harmony Guidelines.
And what are the Harmony Guidelines? What do they say?
The Harmony Guidelines mean you can't be deployed 18 months after you've done a tour. So there has to be a gap, yeah. And I mean, during that time, I'd kind of decided to leave, and I knew I was protected by these guidelines. And I knew that I could sign off. You have to do a year's notice, basically. And I'd been in, I think, 2 or 3 years by then. And I decided I would sign off and leave and do the honourable thing, as it were.
You thought you were safe as far as Afghanistan was concerned. So how did things come to a head?
I was called in and he said, yeah, you're going back to Afghanistan. And it's the first time I've ever kind of offered an opposing view to a senior, because I was always quite rigid about being respectful to people on the basis of how many stripy things they have on their chest. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm not going, because I don't agree with it.
What happened to these guidelines?
You know, the escape clause for them is that they are guidelines and they're not rules as such.
Did you tell the sergeant what you had against the wall?
Yeah, in a very heated kind of debate. And I said, look, I'm not going, and that's it. And he said I was a coward and a malingerer.
Did that hit home in any way?
Oh, certainly I examined it. But if I hadn't been at a low ebb, and I was at a fairly low ebb then, psychiatrically, mentally, and I couldn't kind of fight it at the time.
How soon were you supposed to be going to Afghanistan, and how soon were you faced with the choice about what to do?
Within, I think, the next couple of months from then, but the date changed quite regularly.
You didn't actually go to somebody senior, a commanding officer or an officer of any kind?
No,
say,
I mean...
Look, I'm being sent back to Afghanistan, and I don't want to go.
No, but I mean, I raised it to this sergeant. I would imagine, like, as far as I know, he'd then told them.
Did you discuss it with anybody?
It's a strange one, because when I got to... from rear party, I went into the troop that was getting ready to deploy.
They were preparing to go.
Yeah, and throughout that, I always said, I'm not going. But I never went into the reasons, again, just because I thought they'd think I was mad.
To what extent was your determination not to go back to Afghanistan? How much of that was down to, if you like, the intellectual argument?
Mm-hmm.
And how much was it to do with the impact of the stress?
My issue with Afghanistan, with going back to Afghanistan, was entirely, I mean, it wasn't political, it was ethical, and that was the main driver. I think the PTSD and the lack of treatment for it, the lack of a response for it, was probably what stopped me raising it more strongly.
With the imminent departure for Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and you're on the list, what did you see as your options at that stage?
At that point, they were fairly limited, because I knew at the time I couldn't trust the chain of command. So it was a choice between going, which I considered with my colleagues, and that obligation was very strong, and leaving. I'd exhausted the means. I'd tried to raise my medical condition. I tried to raise my objections and been kind of cut off. And so it was a choice between going and staying.
How strong was the pull of the comradeship, the pull of the institution, the pull of all the things you'd signed up to, admired and enjoyed when you first joined the army?
The pull to my comrades was huge. I mean, that's very human, but the pull to the institution was at that point nil.
If you'd had have gone, you'd have been going just for your mates, would you?
I think so, yeah, but I would have been going as a person who was unwilling to be there and unfit to be there, as it turned out. And I can't understand why that would make any sense to deploy someone who's a liability on the ground anyway.
And the other option is actually running away, isn't it? And you've still got those words from the sergeant ringing in your ears that
for sure.
You didn't like the sort of coward, malingerer type thing. And running away is the kind of antithesis of a soldier's values.
In a sense, but that, I mean, I would say I was running towards something rather than away from something.
And you were absolutely certain in your own mind that your objections to going back to Afghanistan were to do with the morality of the war, not with the danger, the discomfort.
No, I mean, I already had a medal.
The experience.
Yeah, I had the medal. And the idea of war, while terrifying, and it should be terrifying, I mean, I would go and fight to protect something, and I still maintain that now. But I'd come to the conclusion that wasn't what we were doing there.
You know, was there a moment when you realised, I've made the decision now, I've made a choice? What was your plan?
In as much as I had one, I decided I wouldn't go AWOL in the UK because I would be chased. They kind of send out the bounty hunters, as it were. I would leave and go somewhere I knew I could survive cheaply for a few months and try and sort myself out somewhere away where I couldn't be found.
Where did you go and how did you go about it?
I got a plane ticket for Southeast Asia via Bangkok. I even had a set return day. It was 3 months.
Yeah, what were your feelings on the plane as the plane took off?
I drank a lot of free booze to try and kind of subdue myself and go to sleep. But yeah, it was difficult, and I kept thinking I could just get there and then get back on another plane and come back.
You were kind of reassuring yourself that at that stage it wasn't irrevocable.
Yeah, yeah. I could change my mind. You know, it wasn't set in stone yet, even though realistically it was set in stone. I mean, there was always, at that point, a determination underneath that that was me. I was done.
Was there any sense of shame?
A sense of shame, no, I think, because I'd kind of gone through that argument.
That through,
there was probably something residual there, to be honest. You know, there was always that nagging kind of voice, the devil on your shoulder. But, you know, there were some dark days out there. I started drinking a lot. And I think because I was cut off from that part of my support network, that was me, and I'd kind of stepped away from this kind of adopted family. You know, I was out, unplugged, in a sense.
Disconnected.
And cut loose, yeah.
Did they stay dark days?
They did, yeah, for a long time. I kind of drifted around Southeast Asia and smoked a lot of opium, you know, drank a lot. And I think the first high point was I met a guy who became a really good friend in Vietnam, and he was actually a social care worker.
Small irony, you met him in Vietnam, I suppose.
Very strange. And he's the first person I told. You know, I said, I'm in the army, I'm on leave. And then eventually after, I think I was there 3 months, I found out about visas in Australia, and I thought, well, that's somewhere I can go and kind of sort myself out.
Did you have any discomfort at the idea that they were drinking, taking drugs, being a backpacker and on almost a holiday, while your mates were either in Afghanistan or at least preparing to go to Afghanistan? Did that weigh with you in any way?
If it had been a holiday, I mean, I don't consider it a holiday, I consider it me on the run, but if it had been, yeah, it would have been slightly crap. But I think I was pretty numb throughout that whole time, not just chemically, but personally, you know.
Did you have any contact with your family while you were away?
Very briefly, the odd time, but I got in touch with my mum, I remember, and said, look, I'm out here.
Did she understand your position?
She did, yeah, she did understand. She said, they've let you down.
You got to Sydney, and your life took another turning point there, didn't it?
Yeah, on an upward kind of trajectory, I suppose. But yeah, I met a friend of a friend, Claire. We got together after 2 weeks. And I eventually married. But she really was a stabilising force.
And what did she make of, marrying a deserter?
She tried to understand, and she was very supportive, and she took it on board.
Was she a key factor in making you decide to come back?
She was certainly a factor. Obviously, things were going well, and we wanted to kind of settle down together. And that thing would always be hanging over. You know, so we talked about it and progressed and eventually decided to get in touch with AWOL hotline.
There is an AWOL hotline.
There is.
And what are they? I mean, you just ring up and say, hello, I'm Lance Corporal.
Yeah.
Joe Glenton, and I want to come home and face the music.
Effectively, yeah. It was just some civilian guy, I guess. He's a volunteer, and it's an organisation called SAFA, I think.
What was it like finally choosing to come home and face the music?
It was, again, a big decision, and we knew it was coming. Should we go back? And I thought, you know, yeah, I don't have to, but I will, because I want to lay to rest, at least. And I have a case to state, and I will state it.
You were mentally more robust by now?
Much more, yeah. I'd settle back in.
So what was it like, 2 years or more, walking back into the army?
Very, very strange. I mean, even coming back to the UK was strange. We thought I'd get snagged at customs, but we just walked straight through. Yeah, I think we were back about 2 weeks, and then I rang up camp and said, I'm so-and-so. I just went back in, walked back in through the front gate. It was bizarre. And terrifying at the same time, because I didn't know what the response would be.
Were you put under arrest straight away? Or
No, I wasn't arrested. Because I came back voluntarily, they just put me back into work, still as a Lance Corporal.
And what was the response of the serving soldiers to you? Did they resent you? Were they
From being out? Well, no, it was good to catch up with them again. There's no resentment.
None at all?
No.
And the official attitude towards you? I mean,
Was almost indifferent. Obviously, they wanted to know kind of why, and we started down the legal process, but it's not...
But in the end, you weren't charged just with going absent without leave. You were actually charged with desertion.
I argued that I hadn't deserted because I wasn't obliged to go. That was the basis of my argument.
To what extent did you consider using the argument that you'd been suffering from some form of stress?
That was part of it. That was a strand of it, certainly, but that was subsidiary to the fact that I'd had a moral... objection.
At what point and why did you decide to elevate your position into a general argument about stopping the war in Afghanistan, to go public, to talk to the media? I mean, what was all that about?
Whatever trust I'd had in them had gone. I knew they would bury me and ignore my argument. And so I thought, rather than be kind of quiet and skulk, I will fight them.
Your brother died while all this was going on. I mean, he was quite young, wasn't he? He was only 28.
Yeah, he's this was a year ago. He's the age I am now, which is another...
From a chest infection, which seems...
Yes, a massive blow, yeah, a huge blow, but an energising blow as well, in a sense. But it just showed me that you have to fight your causes when you can.
But you were facing a prospect of spending a portion of this life, at any rate, in a military jail. How did the court-martial go?
In the build-up to that, we went at them and they kept adding charges. And I every time I spoke out, they banged another charge on. And then at the very last minute, they said, we'll drop all the charges except for the AWOL.
You'd pleaded guilty to going AWOL, absent without leave.
The sentence was 9 months, of which I did 4.
Was it tough?
No, probably not compared with Afghanistan, but it's tough being away. But again, I mean, it's a military prison and it's full of soldiers. And there was that camaraderie. And I got 200 letters a day at one point from just people outside. So I made it through.
Do you, looking back, regret your choice to run? Had you been in a more robust mental state, would it have been better for you to argue your case?
I think
taking a flight.
It could have been, but I mean, they forced me into that. I try and be kind of pragmatic. You work with the hand you're dealt. You know, I mean, I do have some regrets about it, but not that I went.
And even in those darkest moments of self-examination, are you convinced that everything was due to a principled intellectual objection to the war, or was it some sort of response to the army not being what you had thought it should be or would be, or the responsibilities were too crushing, or some much more subjective, personal?
It was still a moral issue to me, but I mean, you can't really examine it in isolation. I think there were other issues going on, which were the mental health issue. But I mean, that's subsidiary really to the whole thing. I had an objection. I raised it and developed it and tried to examine the arguments in whatever limited way as I could, and made a choice based on that.
Do you miss the army?
Absolutely, yeah. Not the structure, but the people. I'm in a strange position because half of my social circle is serving military and the other half are anti-war protesters.
And what are you up to now?
University.
Doing a course in?
Peace and International Relations in Leeds.
And what are you going to do with that?
Hopefully, I quite fancy being an academic, actually. So I'll have no excuses for not being able to be critical in the future.
Is there anything you regret about the choices you made?
My main regret is that when I had the chance, I didn't go at them harder.
Joe Clinton, thanks very much.
Thank you.